This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents A Steep Price by Robert Dugoni, performed by Emily Sutton Smith. To all the women who have suffered from breast cancer and have fought the good fight, hopefully, someday, research will break through and we finally will have a cure. 1. Tuesday, July 10th, 2018. It had been more than a year since Seattle homicide detectives Del Castigliano and Vic Fazio had worked a case in South Park, but the reason for their visits hadn't changed. Someone had been murdered. On their last case, two attorneys trying to flip homes and spur redevelopment had been shot in one of their properties. A subtle message. South Park wasn't interested in change.
"A world unto itself," Del said, repeating a Seattle Police Department mantra as he drove their pool car across the South Park Bridge over the green-gray waters of the Duwamish River. Just after 4 p.m., a July sun reflected diamonds of sparkling light across the river's surface, and the temperature in Seattle had risen above 85 degrees, without a cloud in the sky. The bridge deposited them onto Cloverdale Street.
"I thought South Park might get redeveloped when the bridge reopened," Foz said.
South Park had what those in real estate considered the most important criteria for redevelopment. Location, location, location. Situated 20 minutes south of downtown Seattle, it was also a stone's throw west of Boeing Field and close to the Seattle-Tacoma Airport. The South Park Bridge had been condemned in 2010 and did not reopen for more than 4 years. Nobody seemed to be in a great rush. If South Park's toxic topsoil and polluted waters did not dissuade redevelopment, crime usually did. South Park's population included a large contingent of Sereno gang members out of Southern California, foot soldiers for the Mexican drug cartels.
"I thought some developer would start buying up property and raise rents, especially with this housing market," Foz continued. "Now I'm thinking that's as likely as me losing weight."
At 6'4", Foz tipped the scale at 270 pounds. He glanced at Del.
"You actually look like you put on a couple pounds."
Del, an inch taller, had lost 50 pounds since starting a relationship with Celia McDaniel, a King County prosecutor.
"I'm eating some carbs again," Del said. "Celia says she likes me better at this weight."
"I like you better at this weight. We were starting to look like Laurel and Hardy," Foz said. "Did Billy call and get us some help?"
Billy Williams was the A-team's sergeant, and Del and Foz the homicide team on call for the week. Ordinarily, Tracy Crosswhite and Kensington Rowe, the other two detectives on the four-person team, would provide support. Crosswhite, however, had been sitting in a homicide trial in King County Superior Court for more than a month.
"He said he'd get somebody."
Del made a right turn and slowed as they approached a stream of parked police vehicles. A crowd stood on the south side of the street, men and women of all ages dressed in tank tops, shorts, and flip-flops. They fanned themselves and shielded their eyes from the glare of the afternoon sun.
"The circus has come to town," Del said, continuing past the CSI van and a fire truck, while looking for a place to park.
4 o'clock on a weekday? This is better than a movie," Foz agreed.
"Park in front of the ambulance."
Del pulled into an angled spot in front of a two-story red brick apartment building. Foz slid from the passenger seat of the air-conditioned car and slipped a lightweight blazer over his long-sleeve shirt and tie.
"I can already feel myself starting to sweat."
"I've been sweating since the day I was born," Del said.
He, too, wore a suit, though he'd removed his tie as a concession to the heat. Foz looked up when he heard the thrum of a hovering news helicopter. First thing they'd need to do, if Billy hadn't done it already, was to get the helicopter the hell out of the area. They badged the officer holding the police log, scribbled their names, badge numbers, and time of their arrival in the log, and ducked beneath yellow and black crime scene tape.
Most of the officers had congregated around a small playground in the center courtyard of the U-shaped apartment building. The body lay beneath a blue sheet near a green jungle gym. Billy stood talking to one of several uniformed officers, but he broke off the conversation when he saw Foz and Dell.
"You call in about the helicopter?" Foz asked.
"Yeah," Billy said, not sounding optimistic his call would do any good. News helicopters could only be fined for being in a police no-fly zone. If the story were big enough, the station would stay and pay the fine.
"Any chance we can argue the apartment is in King County?" Dell said.
"I wish," Billy said.
Some of the streets in South Park were within the King County Sheriff's jurisdiction, and the running joke between the two agencies was that officers rolled bodies across streets to put them in the other's jurisdiction. Though he meant it as a joke, Dell refrained from smiling. With the union trying out body cameras on their uniformed officers, humor no longer had any place at a crime scene. They'd all be on Zoloft by the end of the year. Billy adjusted his driving cap, which shielded his shaved head from the sun.
"This one could get ugly, fast. The decedent is Monique Rogers." He paused, as if the name should mean something to them.
"You might have read about her or seen her on the news, advocating against gangs and drugs in South Park."
"The activist?" Foz said. He recalled something on the news about an African-American woman speaking to the city council about drugs and gangs in the South Park community.
"Would-be activist," Billy said.
"She didn't get all that far."
"Could be the reason she was shot in broad daylight," Foz said. "Someone send in a message."
"Likely," Billy said.
"I'm assuming someone saw it?"
Dell asked.
"One would think, wouldn't he?" Billy said.
"I'm told there were a half dozen moms out here with their kids, but so far everyone is doing the see no, hear no, speak no English act."
"They're scared," Foz said.
"Anyone else hurt?"
Dell asked. Billy shook his head.
"Nothing reported." "So then we're assuming she was the intended victim?"
Foz asked the question as he considered two brick pony walls along the sidewalk, which would have made for good cover if two rival gangs had started shooting at one another. South Park was also home to the Crips and to a couple Asian gangs, though in far fewer numbers than the Serenios. If two gangs had opened fire, Rogers could have been an innocent victim caught in the crossfire.
"We are," Billy said, "given that no one else was shot and witnesses said they only heard the one shooter."
He glanced up at the news helicopter, still hovering.
"TV is going to play up big the fact that it was broad daylight with kids around."
"Where's the family now?"
Foz asked.
"Grandmother got the kids out of here and took them into the apartment."
He pointed to a corner of the U-shaped building.
"Husband has apparently come home from work and is also with them."
"Is anyone saying anything?"
Foz asked.
Billy shook his head.
"We can't even get confirmation on the number of shots or from what direction they were fired. One woman told the responding officer she thought she heard three shots coming from over there."
Williams pointed to a corner of the building.
"They find shell casings?"
Dell asked.
"None," Billy said.
"So the witness either got it wrong," Foz said, "or the shooter used a revolver."
"I got patrol searching for casings," Billy said.
He pointed again to the apartments. "And Anderson Cooper is going door to door." Desmond Anderson and Lee Cooper worked out of the B team, since the Anderson Cooper had become CNN's regular nightly news anchor. The detectives in violent crimes referred to the two-man detective team in the singular.
"We're going to need the video unit," Foz said. "One of the businesses around here might have picked up the shooter fleeing or getting into a car."
The street was mixed use, with apartment buildings, small homes, and corner stores.
"Already on their way," Billy said.
"How much did the kids see?"
Foz asked.
"All of it," Billy said.
Foz turned to the sound of trumpets and guitars, Mexican music, coming from the street. A cherry-red two-door Chevelle with black stripes and gold hubcaps bounced up and down as it drove past the apartment complex.
"Send in the clowns," Dell said.
The man in the passenger seat had a shaved head and a thin mustache that extended to a goatee. Dark sunglasses hugged his face, giving him fly's eyes. His right arm, heavily tattooed, hung out the window. The car slowed and the man removed his sunglasses, staring at Foz.
"Little Jimmy," Foz said.
"All grown up." 10 years earlier, Foz had put Little Jimmy's father in prison. Big Jimmy lasted 6 months. A rival gang member killed him with a shiv. Little Jimmy smiled. Then he made a gun with his thumb and index finger and took aim at Foz, imitating the kick of the barrel as the gun discharged. 2. Tracy Crosswhite grimaced as the defense attorney, Leonard Litwin, tilted the plastic pitcher from the counsel table. A miniature waterfall cascaded into his paper cup, the splatter the only sound in the courtroom. Ostensibly, Litwin needed to quench his thirst, but from her seat on the elevated witness stand, Tracy suspected Litwin had a different motivation for leaving the lectern. Litwin was stalling, like a battered and beaten prizefighter, desperate to reach the final bell. Ordinarily, Tracy wouldn't have cared what Litwin did, or how long it took him to do it. But for 37 of the 53 minutes since the court had last recessed and she had retaken the witness stand, she'd had to pee. Really pee. It seemed unlikely that Litwin, or anyone else in the courtroom, could detect Tracy's urgent problem, or the 16-week baby bump causing it. But that didn't change Tracy's circumstances. Judge Miriam Gowan certainly wasn't going to rush a defense attorney representing a client facing the death penalty, and Tracy wasn't about to bail out Litwin by asking for an early recess. With each passing minute, however, she thought of Beth Duchance, the poor girl who'd wet her pants in the second grade. Duchance had forgotten her homework, and when pressed by their teacher, responded like a frightened miniature poodle before the alpha dog. For the remainder of what had to have been an eternal 8 years, Beth Duchance suffered the humiliation only immature boys and nasty grammar school girls could wreak. They called her Beth Wet My Pants. Tracy had no desire to become similarly etched in the memories of courthouse personnel. Litwin tilted the cup to his lips and drank in painfully slow gulps. Rather than set the glass on the counsel table, he carried it to the lectern and methodically considered pages of notes and testimony in his binder. "Detective Crosswhite, you said..." Litwin looked as if he were about to read, but turned another page and another. In her peripheral vision, Tracy noted several jurors glancing at the large wall clock across the room. The second hand buzzed and lurched past the 12. Finally, Litwin continued. "You said that you found no fingerprints on the knife. Is that correct?" Tracy paused to allow the prosecutor, Adam Hotig, time to object. She'd answered the question twice before, but Hotig sat with his head down, as if he'd taken a sudden interest in his loafers. "That's correct," she said. "So you have no evidence the knife belonged to the defendant, isn't that also true?" Tracy's bladder begged her to let the question go, but she couldn't bypass the opportunity to take another shot at Litwin and his client. "Other than the fact that the defendant told me the knife matched the set of knives in the kitchen drawer?" "No." Her response drew sidelong glances from several of the jurors. Litwin's back stiffened. "I'll rephrase. You have no evidence, Detective Crosswhite, that the knife was used to..." "No forensic evidence the knife was used to stab his wife." "This is like shooting fish in a barrel." "Other than the fact that the knife handle was sticking out of Mrs. Stevenson's chest and she had 7 stab wounds?" "No." The number of glances multiplied. Several jurors smiled. Litwin bristled. His cheeks splashed a splotchy red. "Detective, you have no forensic evidence linking the murder." Tracy cut him off to speed up the process. "The defendant's fingerprints were not found on the knife sticking out of his wife's chest." "That is correct." Predictably, Litwin turned to the bench. "Your Honor, the defense requests that you admonish Detective Crosswhite to allow me to complete my questions before she answers." Gowan glanced at the clock before directing her gaze to Tracy.
Detective, let counsel finish his question.
For one interminable moment, Tracy thought Gowan might allow Litwin to continue. Then she said,
Counsel, it's 4:54. Do you believe you will complete your cross-examination of Detective Crosswhite within the next 6 minutes?
Not a chance.
I estimate that I have another hour, Litwin said.
He didn't, but Litwin and Tracy were both about to get a much-needed reprieve.
Then we'll end for the day, Gowan said, and pick up tomorrow morning with Detective Crosswhite on the witness stand.
When the last of the jurors had collected their belongings and departed to the jury room, Tracy hurried from the witness stand to the courtroom doors. In her peripheral vision, she saw Hotig fast approaching, likely to set a time to meet and discuss Litwin's expected areas of cross-examination in the morning.
I'll call you, she said, deflecting Hotig's advance before he could speak, and hurried out the courtroom door.
3. Foz watched the red Chevelle until it drove out of sight, the music lingering for several more seconds.
Little Jimmy's not so little anymore, Del said.
He wiped the sweat from his brow with a handkerchief.
Yeah, he's now a grown-up shithead, Foz said. Amazing how the garbage never falls far from the trash can.
He seems to remember you, Del said.
Little Jimmy had been 14 when Foz put Big Jimmy in prison.
And he was already a punk then.
Big Jimmy had run drugs in South Park. A rival gang out of Los Angeles tried to step in. A war erupted. 13 gang members died in 2 weeks. Foz's investigation led to the arrest of 8 Sereno gang members, including Big Jimmy, though Big Jimmy never pulled a trigger. The jury determined that Big Jimmy had ordered the hits on the rival gang members, and King County Prosecutor Rick Ceraboni convicted him under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. A jury sentenced Jimmy to 25 years in prison.
I don't like guys pointing a gun at me, fake or not, Foz said. Maybe we pay little Jimmy a visit, determine whether that drive-by was a message to those watching from across the street.
Little Jimmy can count on it, Del said.
Foz turned from the road and walked to the body. He crouched, lifted a corner of the sheet, and considered Monique Rogers. He guessed early 30s. A deep red stain had blossomed on the front of her shirt, and blood ran along the cracks in the concrete. Foz lowered the sheet and stood, his knee cracking when he did. He turned to Billy while eyeing the apartment complex.
Which apartment?
Williams pointed to a corner of the horseshoe-shaped building. A police officer stood on the exterior landing.
Last door.
Foz followed Del up a concrete and wrought iron staircase to a second-floor breezeway cluttered with chairs and charcoal barbecues. Residents stood in the open doors of their sweltering apartments. Several gave Del and Foz the stink eye.
Feeling the love? Del said.
I'm all warm and fuzzy inside, Foz said.
Chatter spilled from the speaker clipped to the officer's shoulder, and he reached to turn down the volume as he handed the clipboard to Foz.
How are they doing?
Foz scribbled his name and badge number and handed the board to Del.
Are they talking?
The officer frowned.
Not a lot.
Anyone in with them now? Foz asked.
No, the officer said. They're in the kitchen. I told them that detectives wished to speak to them.
Foz and Del stepped inside to a living room of worn furniture. To their left, an African-American man sat at a kitchen table looking stunned. In his lap, a young girl pressed against his chest, her thumb in her mouth. Across the table, a woman, perhaps early 50s, held a young boy. A third seat, bathed in a stream of light from a window, remained empty. The room smelled of burned coffee.
Mr. Rogers?
Foz introduced himself and Del.
I'm very sorry about your wife, sir.
The woman got up from her seat carrying the boy. She held out her free hand to the father.
I'll take her.
Where?
Rogers shook his head. Where are you going to go that's safe?
The other room, the woman said. I'll take them to the bedroom. She paused, but when the little girl ignored her hand, she departed with the boy. Faz and Dell would talk to the woman in private and determine what she had seen and heard on the playground. Roger shifted his attention to Faz.
So what are you going to do about it?
He arched his eyebrows in question.
We're going to work very hard to find the persons responsible.
Faz chose his words carefully, with a child still in the room.
And then what?
We'll work very hard to arrest him. Roger shook his head, as if bemused.
The guy who did this? A nobody?
Likely a wannabe gang member, and this was his initiation?
Kill the squeaky wheel.
Faz didn't disagree.
Getting him won't do anything.
Rogers grimaced as if it hurt to say the words.
It's not going to get rid of the drugs, and it's not going to get rid of the gangs, and it isn't going to bring Monique back.
Faz proceeded delicately. If the shooter was following orders, we can bring charges against the person who gave that order. We used that law to get rid of Big Jimmy when he was running drugs down here 10 years ago.
Yeah? And who are you going to get to testify?
This time, it wasn't a question.
We'll take it one step at a time, Faz said.
You said Big Jimmy, the man said.
Little Jimmy's father?
You know Little Jimmy.
Everybody down here knows Little Jimmy. He runs the drugs and he runs the gang. He's the problem.
I understand your wife was a community activist.
Rogers fought back tears. His daughter pressed her head to his chest.
Didn't start out that way, he said. Monique just wanted to get the community together to get rid of the drugs and the guns, to build a better place for our kids. She pushed the community leaders and the supervisors to establish after-school programs so the kids weren't on the street where the gangs can get at them.
Had she been threatened by anyone? Rogers chuckled, but it had a sad quality to it.
All the time, man. All the time.
He shook his head. Then he repeated himself.
All the time. But Monique, she didn't care.
She just went about her business. The gangs used to follow her home. They'd drive by with their music blaring. Faz glanced at Dell. Little Jimmy's drive-by had been more than a flippant display of disrespect. It had been a warning.
Monique set up a community watch program so people could report things they saw to the police.
What was the community's reaction to her efforts? Faz asked.
They were scared,
Rogers said without hesitation.
She set it up so that everything was anonymous, but people were still scared.
Was she getting any traction? Dell asked.
They shot her, didn't they?
Rogers looked away, his gaze not focused on anyone or anything.
Mothers and kids were out there playing, he said,
voice soft.
But they don't care. They don't care who they kill.
He lowered his chin, resting it on his daughter's head, clutching her, holding her tight. Faz knew it was a poor substitute for a mother's embrace. 4. Tracy's walk from the courthouse to police headquarters on Fifth Avenue wasn't far, but it was uphill, and the heat gods had decided this would be the week Seattle burned. By the time she reached police headquarters, she was sweating, and her bladder beckoned yet again. When she stepped off the elevator to the seventh-floor lobby, she nearly collided with Kins. Her partner wore his jacket, preparing to go home. Since his hip replacement 4 months earlier, Kins had been easing his way back into work.
Tracy, hey, I'm glad I caught...
Give me a minute. She hurried past him in the direction of the bathroom. When she pushed in the door, she almost hit a woman standing on the other side.
Sorry, Tracy said.
Detective Crosswhite. The woman spoke Tracy's name as if they knew one another. After several high-profile cases, many officers in the department knew Tracy. She'd also become a mentor to some of the younger female officers, especially those who needed shooting training to pass their qualifying exam. She didn't recognize the woman with shoulder-length auburn hair. The woman extended a hand.
Andrea Gonzalez.
The name also did not ring any memory bells.
Gonzalez looked down at Tracy's stomach.
How far along are you? 6 months?
Tracy pulled closed her suit coat. She'd only told Kins the news. SPD rules mandated that a pregnant officer be put on limited duty, which basically meant desk duty. No thanks.
Who told you?
The woman shrugged.
No one. I can just tell. Though you look great.
Tracy didn't look great. Her face was puffy from water retention, and her hair had wilted from the heat. She'd also put on 10 pounds and felt fat. Gonzalez, on the other hand, looked as fresh as if she'd just come in to work. Maybe she had. She wore creased black slacks and a matching jacket over a blue shirt that accentuated what Foz would have referred to as well-developed assets.
I guess I'll be taking your place when you're out on maternity leave?
Gonzalez's voice inched higher, as if she meant it as a question, though it came out a statement.
What do you mean, taking my place?
Gonzalez smiled.
I'm just assuming that's why they hired me.
She paused.
I'm sorry. I thought your department would have told you I was starting this week. I'm the A-team's new fifth wheel.
No one had told Tracy anything. What about Ron Mayweather? Gonzalez shrugged.
Who's he?
She moved to the counter, checking her appearance in the mirror, then turning on the water and washing her hands.
He's our fifth wheel. Has been for several years. I don't know. I was just told to report to the A-team today.
Gonzalez glanced at Tracy's reflection in the mirror.
So I guess we'll be working with each other. For a few months, at least.
Gonzalez dried her hands and deposited the towels in the trash.
Nice meeting you, she said, and departed.
Tracy watched the door swing shut. She looked at her reflection in the mirror, focusing on the baby bump. She'd bought several shirts and jackets cut to hide her pregnancy. No one in the office had mentioned anything to her. Then again, she worked with three men who wouldn't ask a woman if she was pregnant unless she was giving birth. Still, the ease and the rapidity with which Gonzalez noted Tracy's condition made her wonder if someone had told her. And if someone had, it made her wonder if that was why Gonzalez had been hired. Not to fill in, but to take Tracy's place. 5. Tracy tossed a paper towel into the garbage bin and stepped from the bathroom to the lobby. Kins leaned against the wall, trying to look engaged on his phone.
Did you know about this? She asked.
Kins nodded like a busted teenager. I didn't know she was in the bathroom, but that's what I wanted to talk to you about. She just showed up this morning. Nolasco introduced her, said she was starting as our fifth wheel.
She knows I'm pregnant.
Tracy lowered her volume as more people entered the lobby.
How the hell does she know I'm pregnant?
Kins shook his head. I don't know. I didn't tell her. He looked around the lobby and nodded for Tracy to follow him down the hall. They slipped into a conference room and he shut the door. Look, I'm heading to South Park. Dell and Foz got a murder and need help with interviews, so I don't have a lot of time. Did Gonzalez say how she knew?
No. She said she could tell, which I find unlikely since we've never met.
And she said she was taking your place?
She said she assumed that's why she'd been hired.
I'm sure she meant it was just for your maternity leave, he said.
So then why did Nolasco move Ron? Why not just let him step in, like when you went out for your hip?
Ron's been reassigned to the C team.
When did that happen?
I just found that out late this morning when Gonzalez showed up. Apparently Arroyo is retiring in January. That news caught Tracy by surprise.
Arroyo is retiring?
Kins shrugged. Apparently. They were getting off topic.
Ron's been working with us for 3 years, she said. Why would Nolasco reassign him?
Maybe because none of us is going anywhere? You're not, are you?
What does that mean?
It means I assume you're coming back after you have the baby. You are, aren't you?
This is no different from your hip surgery. You were out, Ron filled in, now you're back.
Yes, but I didn't have to leave my hip at home, Tracy. For a moment she didn't speak, uncertain of Kinz's point. Then she said,
What?
You know how it is.
That's your baby you're leaving at home. And you don't have to work. We all know Dan does well. Better than well.
Tracy and Dan had married a year earlier. Dan just hired someone so he could spend more time at home. I'm not planning on quitting, Kins.
Kins had a strange expression, like a man standing on the edge of a cliff, terrified to jump.
What? She asked.
He shook his head. Nothing.
What?
Nothing. I gotta go.
If you think I'm acting irrationally, tell me.
He looked at his watch.
Okay, look, just promise not to bite my head off, all right?
This is just a friend talking to a friend. Someone who's been down this path before.
Kins had three sons.
Fine, Tracy said.
Kins laughed uneasily.
Tracy, I know you. You're listening, but you're ready to take me down and remove my gallbladder with your hands.
She pulled out a chair and sat, crossing her legs.
I'm calm, okay?
And I'm listening.
Kins took a moment to either gather his thoughts or his courage. He stepped off the ledge.
This is your first child, so I think it's safe to say that you can't fully predict how you're going to feel when the baby is born.
I know.
Kins raised a hand.
Just hear me out.
She raised both hands as if to say, fine, continue.
I know that when you have a kid, you think nothing is going to change, that work isn't going to change. But it does. Everything changes, and not for the worse. It just changes. That's the hard part. Leaving the best part of you at home with someone else. The best part of you is being raised by someone else. I didn't want that. Neither did Shanna. So she quit her job and stayed home, even though we couldn't really afford it. And even with Shanna at home, it was still hard as hell for me, Tracy. I'd get to work and I couldn't wait to leave, to get back home and see my boys.
Tracy knew from years working together what Kins's boys meant to him. She'd watched them grow and heard the stories.
I couldn't wait to coach them in Little League and go to their high school games. I loved it. I've loved every minute of it. Now, in a couple months, we'll be taking Connor off to college. And I'm already dreading that day because I know it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt to know he's not sleeping in his bed, that he has another bed and another life with people I don't even know.
Kins's voice choked, and Tracy knew he was fighting to suppress his emotions. After a pause, he blew out a held breath.
I know every parent goes through it. Every parent has to say goodbye. But trust me, that doesn't make it any easier. So I'm just telling you, it goes by so fast. Before you know it, and much sooner than you ever expected, you'll be driving them off to college and saying goodbye. And you'll ask yourself, where did the years go? You'll look at pictures and you can't even remember when they were that small, and you'll wish they still were, that you could go back to those days and just have them home again. So what I'm telling you is, don't look at staying home as some punishment, Tracy. Because if you do, you'll regret it. And, look, I gotta go.
Kins pulled open the door and departed without finishing the sentence. But he didn't have to.
Tracy knew what he was thinking, but didn't say.
And this might be your only child. After leaving the conference room, Tracy grabbed a decaffeinated coffee from the kitchen, which she thought best given her current agitated state, and headed to her desk. She felt flushed, as warm as she'd felt walking up the hill to police headquarters. Her conversation with Andrea Gonzalez kept filtering through her mind. How far along are you? 6 months?
God, did she look that big already?
Kins, too, had surprised her. She knew he loved his three boys without question. But he'd also told her the unflattering stories, the stupid things the boys did, the pandemonium in the house, the trips to school because one of the boys was in trouble or failing a class. It had been hard to watch him in the conference room on the verge of tears because one of his sons was leaving for college. It was raw emotion, something police officers didn't let out often with other officers, if at all. Tracy stepped into the A-team's bullpen. Andrea Gonzalez sat at Tracy's desk, which simply was never done at SPD. Desks and cubicles were sacrosanct.
Fifth Wheels sat at computer terminals in the back of the room. Gonzalez looked like she'd moved in. She'd hung her jacket in Tracy's cubicle closet, and a Starbucks coffee cup with red lipstick on the rim rested on Tracy's desk pad. "Excuse me," she said. Gonzalez turned. "What are you doing at my desk?" "What?" Tracy pointed to her desk. "What are you doing at my desk?" Gonzalez looked as if she didn't understand the question. "I understood you were testifying in court all day. Captain Nolasco told me to get caught up on your case files." Tracy looked at the computer and saw a document on the screen. "How'd you get into my case files?" "Captain Nolasco had IT provide me with a generic password." Tracy clenched her teeth, afraid of what she might say. She should have known Nolasco would have something to do with this. Nobody would be happier to have Tracy leave. "Let me clear out," Gonzalez said. She stood and grabbed her coffee. "Listen, I'm sorry. I didn't know this was a breach of some protocol. In L.A., we often just picked a desk not being used and logged in." Tracy wasn't interested in the debate. "I need to make a phone call." Gonzalez checked her watch. "I feel like we're getting off on the wrong foot here. Can I buy you a beer?" She cringed and glanced at Tracy's stomach. "I'm sorry. Maybe something non-alcoholic?" Tracy suppressed her anger, thinking it better directed at Nolasco than Gonzalez. Maybe her hormones were just out of whack. "Thanks, but I can't. I'm in trial, and I need to contact the prosecutor to prepare for tomorrow." "Right, I heard that. Anyway, sorry about using your desk." Gonzalez departed the cubicle. Tracy sat and hit the spacebar. The computer went to her password-protected screen, as it always did when the keyboard remained idle for a prolonged period. She typed in her password, and the computer screen came back to life. She was looking at a file Dell had apparently opened on the South Park shooting, though it was still blank. Her emails, too, had been opened. She checked the sent folder, but nothing had been sent from her computer since she'd last used it the prior afternoon. Her desk phone rang. Now fully paranoid, she deliberately did not use her normal greeting, which included her name, in case the call was for Gonzalez. "Hello?" she said.
"I'm trying to reach Detective Crosswhite?"
A female voice, but not one Tracy recognized. "This is Detective Crosswhite."
"Tracy?"
The caller sounded confused.
"It's Katie. Katie Pryor."
"Katie, hi. Sorry. I was just busy with something and never mind. Hey, how do you like the new job?"
6 months earlier, Talia Greenwood had retired from the missing persons unit after more than 30 years. Tracy had recommended Pryor for the job. Pryor, a mother of two young girls with a husband who liked her at home, had told Tracy one afternoon at the shooting range that she was looking for something with more stable hours.
"I like it.
Well, as much as anyone can like searching for missing persons. The structured hours allow me to better plan my time at home with the kids." There had been a time when just the mention of the words "missing person" caused a visceral reaction in Tracy. Her sister, Sarah, had been abducted and her whereabouts unknown for more than 20 years. With time, she'd become more accepting.
"Listen, I don't want to keep you," Pryor said. "I know you're in the Stevenson trial, but I got in a report from a woman who thinks her roommate is missing, and I don't have a good feeling about it. I ordinarily wouldn't bother you without more information, but my captain is in Europe for the next 2 weeks, and the woman who made the report is leaving the country to live in London. I thought it best to have someone in violent crimes talk with her before she goes. The person missing doesn't sound like someone who'd just take up and leave."
"How old is she?" Tracy asked.
24. The two women shared an apartment in the university district near the UW campus.
Students?
Graduates. The missing woman was apparently applying to medical schools. Most missing persons tended to be either in a high-risk profession, like prostitution, or have high-risk circumstances, the addicted, mentally challenged, or the elderly suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia.
"This woman making the report was her roommate?" Tracy asked.
"Up until recently."
"What happened recently?"
"The woman who made the report got married in India, unexpectedly, from the sound of it.
She didn't even get the chance to tell her roommate about it until she got back. She's the one moving to London.
Okay, so why does she think her roommate's missing?
She can't reach her on her cell, and she isn't responding to text messages or emails. She said she's just disappeared. It's complicated.
How long has she been gone?
Getting close to 24 hours.
Tracy knew 24 hours could be an eternity to a family, but not to SPD, though that, too, was changing. SPD used to wait 48 hours before considering a person missing, but they'd become more vigilant after a recent case in which a nurse met a man online and went missing. They found her body parts scattered in garbage bins throughout the city. Pryor continued.
She said they've been friends since childhood and that she wouldn't just run away.
Tracy heard Pryor rustling papers.
Sorry, this is confusing. The one making the report is named Aditi Dasgupta.
Indian.
Yes, Dasgupta said she and her roommate, Kavita Mukherjee, have gone to school together since they were kids, and they've lived together in an apartment in the U District the last 2 years. Both had been planning on attending medical school.
I'm not following.
Neither was I. The officer who took the report said the one filing the report, Dasgupta, recently got married in India, an arranged marriage, apparently. The missing roommate, Kavita Mukherjee, didn't know about the wedding.
She didn't know her roommate got married?
Apparently not. Anyway, Dasgupta said the roommate, Kavita Mukherjee, was pretty upset when she found out.
Could she just be upset and need some time alone to process everything that has happened?
Maybe, but Dasgupta doesn't think that's the case. She said it's not like her.
Have you filled out an EMPA yet? Tracy asked, referring to an endangered/missing person alert.
I haven't had the chance. I've been making telephone calls to the family and several friends, and to her employer. No one has heard from her.
Tracy looked at the clock in the lower right corner of her computer screen. She'd hoped to get home at a decent hour. She also knew Nolasco would never let her take a missing persons case, not without more substantial evidence of a violent crime, and not with Del and Foz pulling a murder in South Park and likely needing support.
Are you still in your office? Tracy asked.
I am.
I'll stop by on my way home, she said. I have to make a phone call. Can you stay for a bit?
I'll stay, Pryor said.
You want me to send you what I have? Tracy didn't, given that it was unlikely Nolasco would agree to let her run with it. Print out the report for me. I'll pick it up when I stop by.
I appreciate it. I know you're busy, but you know how you get a sense about these cases? When something just doesn't seem right?
Tracy did. All too well. 6. Anderson Cooper went door to door at the apartment complex in search of witnesses to the shooting, while Del and Foz canvassed the local businesses for videotape that might have captured the killer fleeing the scene, or getting into a car, anything. It was already early evening, and some of the businesses had closed. Foz kept a log of those that had, so detectives could return first thing in the morning. If the business had video, they'd want to get there before that video was recorded over. He'd also called the traffic division and asked that traffic cameras in that area be checked and film preserved. Monique Rogers' mother said she'd heard shots fired on the east side of the apartment complex. If correct, South Cloverdale, which ran parallel with the building, would have been a natural escape route for the shooter. The owner of a gas station at the end of the block said his camera focused on the gas pumps, but it might have recorded a portion of the street. To keep things moving, Del and Foz left a detective from the video unit to go through the footage while they drove to a convenience store across the street, which was also a good bet to have videotape. Foz pushed open the glass door, causing a string of bells tied to the inside handle to rattle. A man tall enough to look him in the eye, and as wide as Foz and Del combined, greeted them with a scowl.
"Can I help you?"
The man had a bun of curly black hair. He folded meaty arms across his chest and rested them on an ample stomach. Elaborate tattoos encircled biceps as big as most men's legs. He wore shorts, a t-shirt, and flip-flops. Foz and Del introduced themselves and explained the reason for their presence.
The owner had a soft handshake and a voice higher pitched than Foz would have imagined for a man his size. He introduced himself as Tanielu Eliapu, but said,
"Guys, call me Tani. It's easier. I heard about what happened to that lady."
"How'd you hear?"
"It was on the news, man."
He turned and pointed to a small television hanging above the checkout counter where a woman, who also looked to be of Polynesian descent and was also very big, sat on a wooden stool, eyeballing them with a sullen expression. An oscillating fan on the counter rotated left to right and back, causing the woman's floral dress and strands of hair to flutter.
"Hey!"
Tani turned and shouted at two Hispanic kids near a magazine rack at the storefront. They flinched and looked up at him. Tani pointed to a sign on the wall.
"If you're reading it, you're buying it. Make a choice."
And he pointed to a mounted camera hanging from the ceiling.
"Surprise, man. You're on candid camera. If I don't catch you, the camera does, and then I finish you."
Tani continued to eye them until they put the magazine back on the rack and walked to the register, carrying soda and candy. He turned back to Foz.
"I heard people are afraid to talk to the police."
"Where'd you hear that?" Foz asked, doubtful it was from the news.
"Word on the street spreads fast, man."
"What else have you heard?" Del asked.
"I heard little Jimmy's getting the word out that he doesn't want anyone talking to you."
So Foz's assumption that little Jimmy had some involvement appeared accurate.
"You know him?"
Foz asked.
"Know of him? Ricardo Luis Bernardino Jimenez."
Tani said the name quickly and made a face like he'd detected a bad odor.
"He's a punk. I've heard that his father, Big Jimmy, was a big deal here in South Park, that he did a lot for the people."
"Little Jimmy isn't a big deal, though he thinks he is. Heard he's working for one of the Mexican cartels. Back then, Big Jimmy was dealing pot. Little Jimmy's dealing heroin. Bad shit, man. That stuff will kill you." Foz glanced at Del, who'd lost his niece to a heroin overdose less than 6 months earlier. Del didn't say anything.
"You're not afraid of him?" Foz asked.
Tani scoffed like the question was ridiculous.
"What's he going to do? He knows if he touches me or my business, the brothers will not be happy. Trust me, he don't want nothing to do with the brothers, man."
Foz could see why, given Tanny's size, not to mention the woman behind the counter. She looked like she could eat glass shards and shit a stained glass window. He pointed to the ceiling.
"You have video?" he asked.
Tani nodded to the woman.
"Pika likes to look at the video every night. She can watch on her phone. She sees anybody steal anything the next time they come in. It's not so good for them. Me, I don't like people who steal. Pika, she's biblical about it."
He shrugged and gave them a broad smile.
"Can we look at the tape for today? About 3 o'clock, maybe a little before?"
Foz asked.
"You wanna see?"
Tani asked.
"Absolutely," Del said.
"Pika, I'll be in the back."
He nodded to two young men who'd walked in the front door.
"Watch those two. If they steal anything, break their arms."
He smacked a meaty fist into his palm and grunted before leading Del and Foz through a door at the back of the store to a computer set on a folding table. The room was cluttered with boxes and cleaning supplies and had the sharp smell of ammonia. In the corner, the wooden handle of a mop protruded from a metal bucket and leaned against the edge of a large sink. The lone window above the computer was fogged glass, barred on the inside.
"You like my office?"
Tani laughed and spread his arms wide, as if showing off the place.
"It's a dump, man."
He typed at the keyboard with stubby fingers, then circled with the mouse.
"You set around 3 o'clock today?"
"Approximately," Foz said, slipping on cheaters to see the screen clearly. Tani typed again. A black and white image appeared on the screen with a date and time bar in the bottom right corner. He used the mouse to advance the video, stopping at 2:33 p.m. Then he let it run at regular speed. The image on the computer screen focused primarily on the interior of the store and the counter where Pika sat. But it also showed the glass door entrance and a portion of the parking lot and the street. Still, Foz's barometer that the video had captured anything useful remained doubtful. They watched the video as people entered the store, bought items, and departed. Foz paid close attention to the street, cars passing the store and pulling into and out of the parking lot, people walking. Nearly 15 minutes had passed when Del said,
"Can we speed it up? If we see anything, we can stop and go back."
"No problem, man," Tanny said. He hit the fast-forward button and the tape speed increased, though not dramatically. "You want to go faster, man?"
"No, this is good for now," Del said.
After several minutes, Foz said, "Wait, go back."
"You see something?" Del asked.
"I don't know."
Tanny rewound the tape.
"Right there, stop it. Now go forward," Foz said. "Stop. You see?" he said to Del. He pointed a finger at the right corner of the screen where someone had appeared, though the image was fuzzy.
"Yeah, I see," Del said, not sounding impressed.
"Play it," Foz said, leaning closer to the screen. The person jogged into the picture and across a patch of lawn, toward the street, too far from the camera for them to see any features.
"Stop it," Foz said.
He leaned in closer. "What's he wearing over his face?"
"I see him," Tanny said, pointing with his index finger.
"That's a hoodie, man. You know, a sweatshirt. He has the hood up, you see?"
"Yeah, I see," Foz said.
"I think you're right. He's got it pulled tight around his face," Tanny said.
"It had to be 90 degrees today," Del said.
85, Tanny said. "It's crazy, I know, but they wear them all the time around here. Hoodies and tank-top t-shirts."
"Tied shut like that?" Del asked.
"That I don't see so much," Tanny said. Foz looked for identifying characteristics, a team logo, something to distinguish the hooded sweatshirt. If there were any, the distance was too great for them to see clearly. He glanced down at the time in the lower right corner of the computer screen, then up at Del.
"Right time." "Right location," Del said. The path to the street would have been from the back of the apartment complex.
Tanny looked between the two of them. "You think this could be your shooter?"
"Hard to tell," Del said. "Might be nothing."
"How are you going to identify him wearing a hoodie like that?" Tanny said.
"Don't know," Foz said. "Continue playing it."
Tanny hit the button and the man stepped from the curb. He stumbled, as if he'd twisted an ankle, and to maintain his balance, placed his left hand on the hood of a parked car. Then he righted himself and limped across the street, dodging southbound traffic. He nearly ran out of the picture frame before he climbed into the passenger seat of what looked to be a white SUV or truck. Foz couldn't tell. A split second before the vehicle drove out of the camera frame.
"Did you see that?" Foz asked.
"I saw," Del said.
Tanny hit stop and looked to Del and Foz.
"So what do you think, brudda?"
Del spoke to Foz.
"I doubt we can get a license plate on the white SUV even if we get the tape enhanced. It's too far and not enough frames for them to work with. But we might be able to get the plate of the parked car he put his hand on."
"Maybe," Foz said.
"Traffic cameras could have picked up the white vehicle he got into. And just in case, we should check local hospitals, see if anyone came in with an ankle injury."
"Doubt it, but worth a shot," Del said.
Foz pulled out his cell phone to contact the video unit detective. He turned to Tanny.
"I'm going to have somebody come down here and retrieve the video."
"No problem, man," Tanny shrugged. Foz held out a business card. It looked as small as a postage stamp in Tanny's hands.
"I know you're not afraid of little Jimmy, and I don't want to tell you what to do. But I'd keep this quiet," Foz said. "Little Jimmy might be a punk, but if he's running the Serenios, that could quickly become a problem for you."
Tanny smiled. "I ain't stupid, man. What do you seen out there?" He pointed with his thumb to the door leading to the interior of the store. "That was just for show, man. You can't show fear around here. You show fear and people will steal you blind. But in here? Yeah, brudda. I understand. I ain't looking to take no bullet. Like I say, little Jimmy. He's crazy loco."
7. Tracy hung up after speaking to the prosecutor, Adam Hotig. They'd discussed her testimony, as well as possible areas that Leonard Litwin would attempt to attack her in his restructured cross-examination. She also told Hotig she had a bladder infection and would appreciate a break mid-morning if Litwin planned to go longer than an hour.
Since Tracy was the last witness scheduled to testify, and Hotig didn't anticipate rebuttal witnesses, he begged off meeting in person so he could work on his closing argument. After the call, Tracy made her way to the outer offices. She wanted to catch Nolasco before he went home. She wanted to ask him about Ron Mayweather and about Arroyo's apparent impending retirement, as well as get a feel for whether Nolasco knew about her pregnancy and had told Gonzalez. The blinds to his office windows were lowered and pinched shut, preventing her from seeing inside. Tracy knocked on a closed door, heard Nolasco say, "Enter," and pushed the door in. Nolasco sat behind his desk, holding a mug of tea. Across from him, Andrea Gonzalez sat in one of two chairs. She turned to look at Tracy.
"You two have met?" Nolasco said.
"Yeah," Tracy and Gonzalez said at the same time. Tracy looked to Nolasco. "I'll come back."
"No," Gonzalez stood. "I'm just on my way out. Thanks, Captain. I'm on it."
She smiled at Tracy as she stepped past her.
"You need to hear this, too," Nolasco spoke before Tracy had taken a step inside his office. "You heard about the shooting in South Park?"
Tracy nodded. "Yeah, from Kins when I got in from court."
"Someone shot into a playground at an apartment complex and killed a mother of two. She'd been outspoken against the drugs and gangs down there. The news is all over it, which means they're all over us. I'm sending anyone I can to help Del and Foz canvass the area. Where are you at in your trial?"
"Back on the stand tomorrow morning."
"Who's after you?"
"No one, unless Hotig calls someone on rebuttal or Litwin changes his mind overnight. Hotig thinks he'll give closing late morning or early afternoon."
"Del and Foz are going to need your help as soon as you're finished," he said.
The lead detective in a homicide trial typically sat with the prosecutor at counsel table from pre-trial motions until the jury delivered its verdict. It was intended to give a human face to the state's case. "Are we operating under the premise that the killing was retaliatory?" Tracy asked.
"We are."
"That's Sereno territory down there," Tracy said. She'd had two gang killings in South Park.
"I want you to call Del and Foz as soon as you're done and find out what they need."
Nolasco lowered his head, apparently thinking their conversation had concluded. He looked up when Tracy didn't leave.
"Something else?"
"Did you provide Gonzalez a password to get onto my computer?"
"No. I told her to check with IT for a temporary password."
"You know she has a computer back in administration, right? She didn't have to use mine."
"With Del and Foz gone, and you and Kins in trial, I wanted someone in the bullpen. And I wanted her to get familiar with your files so she could hit the ground running."
"Yeah, but using my computer with a temporary password, she could access my privatized files, my report files." Detectives could all access the unit files, but only the lead detective on any particular case could open the report files or privatized files. Any unauthorized access of those files was reported to the lead detective in a V-mail, which stood for Versaterm.
"All of you are too attached to your terminals. Files are supposed to be open so the work is collaborative. I don't understand the problem,"
Nolasco said. Tracy couldn't be sure if Nolasco was pushing her or not. She decided to push him. "Ron knew what was going on?"
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Ron was our fifth wheel, and he was up to speed on our files."
"Yeah, and we had an opening on C-Team. Arroyo is retiring end of the year."
"I heard."
"Did you hear that Ron wanted the position, which left an opening for a fifth wheel on A-Team?"
"Ron wanted to move teams?" Nolasco stared at her.
"Anything else?"
"You hired Gonzalez awfully quickly."
"No, I didn't. That took place above me, and has been in the works since Arroyo told the brass he was leaving."
He paused.
"You know, most detectives would have thanked me."
Tracy said, "For what?"
"For putting the quality of your team first and getting someone quickly up to speed."
Tracy nodded. "Well, then thank you."
"Anything else?"
Tracy shook her head. She wasn't going to get anything more out of Nolasco, and Katie Pryor was waiting for her at the Park 95 complex.
"As soon as you're free, give Foz and Del a hand," Nolasco said.
Tracy drove to the Park 95 complex,
the department name for the concrete buildings on Airport Way that housed much of the Seattle Police Department's forensic units, CSI, and specialty units such as SWAT. She made her way to the missing persons unit. Well after 6 o'clock,